This episode of Section D was first aired on Tuesday the 18th of December on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. It's the last regular Section D of 2012 and we're ending on something of a cracker. We'll be heading from Seoul to Singapore, Vienna, Paris, London and New York, taking in the worlds of design, architecture, branding, jewellery and even fragrance. Yes, we've pulled out all the stops this week to end 2012 on a design high. Coming up, we attend the President's Design Awards in Singapore, in the presence of the President, Tony Tan Keng Yam, himself.
Some of the award recipients today, a lot of them are a lot younger. You know, it's in their blood, you know, they live and breathe design, they live and breathe creativity, you know, they innovate.
Our associate editor, Nelly Gochiva, gets a lesson in how to spritz for Christmas from Cartier's in-house nose, Mathilde Laurent.
What is important is the perfume, the fragrance. If you pay too much attention to the bottle, it means that there is a trick, there is something wrong, you know?
Elsewhere, we drop in on a new exhibition in Vienna, examining the legacy of Soviet architecture. Over in Seoul, we attend a design convention promoting independent local designers. And in New York, we sit down with master craftsman John Derrian, who tells us that the art of decoupage is alive and kicking. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D. We begin this week's Section D over in Seoul. Think South Korean design and names like Hyundai, Samsung and LG likely come to mind first. Independent designers in South Korea have had trouble breaking out from behind the big corporations. But this is gradually beginning to change. The annual Seoul Design Festival, which took place last week, gives a platform to younger, independent-spirited creatives to exhibit their work. We sent our correspondent in Seoul, Jason Struther, to check it out.
I'm surrounded by some of the most unusual umbrellas I've ever seen. There's ones made of metal, another shaped like a small table, and another made of feathers. There are even weaponized umbrellas, which, judging by this grim-looking mannequin standing behind them, could be used to fight in the zombie apocalypse. This display is the centerpiece of this year's Seoul Design Festival. For each of its past 11 years, a dozen or so designers choose a household object and give it their own spin. Kim On-yu, the Design Festival's project manager, says Korea is battling a barrier in regard to design, and the festival is a way for up-and-coming designers to break through.
We want to focus on designers, not just products at the festival. In the past, South Korea was known only as a country that factory produces things, but not as one that actually designs products. But things are changing now, and our designers are gaining more attention internationally.
Taking a stroll around the convention hall floor, I spot booths showcasing designer jewelry, wine label bottles, stationery, and for some reason, several stands featuring decorative socks. There is also a small garden with potted orange trees. I ask Oh Kyung-ah what this is all about.
So this booth is represented some sort of agriculture and design. As a garden, I'm a garden designer. I created some citrus garden.
Oh gives me a tour of her small citrus garden.
So this is a container package. So I put in citrus tangerine. So after that, this bag can use planter box. Normally, package is cannot recycled. So I concentrate on I want to create a recycled package. So good for our health and also for earth as well.
Going from outdoor to indoor design, the festival also gives furniture makers some space to present their work. And in a country where IKEA has yet to open up shop, there's a real need for interesting, modern-looking home goods. Yang On-gu uses wood and aluminum in his furniture designs. He says that traditional Korean furniture with their square, straight-line contours just don't match his taste. He prefers making designs with curves and rounded edges. He shows me a four-level bookshelf with aluminum shelves and a rounded wooden frame, no sharp edges on this. He says he wants his designs to reflect stability. In South Korea, indoor design might just be as important as online design. Korea is, of course, the most wired country in the world, and Koreans spend many hours online each day. Most people rely on the portal site Naver to help navigate the net. Kim Piljun is on Naver's marketing team, which co-sponsored the design festival.
You know, Naver is very conscious about the design and user experience, brand experience, because you know, Naver is like everywhere in Korea. Everyone use Naver, so we're trying to improve the user experience. In terms of, you know, the design technology.
Kim leads me past a row of poster-sized screenshots that show how Naver's homepage design has changed over the years.
Okay, this is, you know, like 1999
okay.
design, you know, the main page of the Naver.
Mm.
So at the time, you know, early stage of the, you know, internet portal search things.
Mm.
So as you see, it's like a directories of, you know, all the different stops.
As Kim explains, Naver's design evolved from that basic directory look to an interface that is based on what's most popular. Categories such as movies, message boards, and web cartoons are listed according to how many clicks they've received. And considering that South Koreans use smartphones or smart devices more than people from any other country, trying to cram all of Naver's information onto a tiny screen while still being comfortable for the user was a challenge, says Kim.
So we're trying to show, you know, pack inside the everything in this small page. So we found that.
You're showing me on your iPhone?
Yeah. As you see, you can swipe.
Okay.
And you can a lot of different, you know, contents. The reason I show this one is, you know, this is how we try to improve the usability and user experience. So, you know, our main goal of the design is making people to use it very usefully.
to enjoy the experience, to enjoy going online. Yeah.
Given its ubiquity here, it might not be so surprising that the internet has actually brought positive influences on Korea's designers. Again, Design Festival Manager Kim On-yu.
아무래도 인터넷의 영향이 많이 컸다고 생각을 합니다. 그래서 세계의 많은 것들의 정보를 접하면서 이미 기존
The internet has really helped give Korean designers international perspective. In the past, designers were only concerned with creating things for local tastes. But now, the designers' exposure to foreign ideas is reflected in the products they make. That, mixed with the Western notion that Asian designs are somehow mysterious, makes Korean products more appealing in the global market.
For Monocle in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Jason. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Cartier, the renowned French jewellery and watchmaker, was founded by Louis-François Cartier in Paris back in 1847. Today, to add to the company's extensive collection of accessories, is Cartier's range of fragrances, available in the brand's 200 stores across 125 countries. Associate editor Nelly Gochiva caught up in London with Cartier's in-house nose, Mathilde Laurent. She learned about the art of fragrance creation, and tactfully, Nelly also asked if a bottle of perfume could or should ever be given as a Christmas present. But first, Nelly began by asking Mathilde about her fascination with fragrances and where it all started.
Many years ago, in the great houses of perfumery, nobody cared about the bottles. Everybody cared about the fragrances. And today we have to find this way of thinking perfume. What is important is the perfume, the fragrance. If you pay too much attention to the bottle, it means that there is a trick, there is something wrong, you know. When you go and you want to buy a perfume, you should always pay attention to the bottle if it's too beautiful or too worked, too tricky bottle, it means that there is nothing in it, in, you know? Because what has to be really wonderful and amazing and what has to cost a lot is the fragrance, not the bottle.
So should we assume clear and simpler packaging means maybe better content?
In fact, yes, finally, it means if you see a luxury packaging which is very simple, it means that the house wanted to show that the importance is in the bottle. And I think it's something we have to find again.
So speaking of the new Cartier fragrances, can you just walk us through all these fragrances notes that everybody use when describing perfumes? It's always so difficult to describe a fragrance and even more challenging for people to understand such reviews. We have top notes, middle notes, base notes. So what do all these fragrance notes mean and which one is the most relevant and important one in the end?
If you want me to tell you what these notes, middle, top and bottom means, I would say exactly nothing. You know, because in fact in a perfume there are lots of ingredients. Sometimes there are many, maybe 50, and sometimes there are till 300 ingredients. So it is obvious that it is not because you put 10 ingredients in a pyramid that you have described the perfume, and you will notice that they are always the same. So you could believe that every perfume smells the same because every perfume says the same ingredients. So there is something to understand, and the ingredients that are often mentioned are the natural ones. It is strange, don't you think? Nobody says there is linalyl acetate, there is benzyl acetate in the pyramid. It is too bad, I would say, because there is a lot of benzyl acetate in our perfumes today on the market. So these pyramids are totally fake, you know, and this is why in Cartier I don't want to use them. We don't use the olfactory pyramids. We don't describe the perfumes with top and middle and bottom notes. In Cartier, I tried to explain, and we do that now, that what is important is the intention. It is as if you would go to see a Monet painting, Le Jardin, Le Déjeuner sur l'herbe, and everybody describes it saying, there is blue, there is green, there is white, and there is black, and a hint of red. So it is not Le Déjeuner sur l'herbe, it is maybe a Picasso, it is maybe a Magritte, it can be anything, because everybody uses blue, red, and black and green. So in our perfumes, we try to describe it as a wonderful picnic in a sunny day near a lake. And for Baiser Volé, it is a wonderful bouquet of lilies, and a woman passing by this bouquet found it so beautiful that she wanted to crush it on her neck. And when you smell Baiser Volé on a woman, you believe that she wears a necklace of lilies. So we try to explain that, and for Déclaration d'un soir, it is the same. It is like a filter, something that would have been created by a gentle genius to help men to declare their flame, their love. Because we know that men sometimes hesitate too much anyway to declare. So I decided to create a filter, something to help, something to give courage and to help them dare. So this is a work about pepper to make hearts move.
And speaking about fragrances and the way to wear them, can you tell us some tricks to put on perfume effectively? Where should we apply it on the body?
I would say put perfume effectively is a nonsense. You know, you don't have to be effective when you wear a perfume. What is important is to be seductive. So I always fight for freedom with perfumes. You just have to put perfume as you want to be perfumed, as you want to wear the perfume, whether if it's to not be disturbed by your perfume, because people wear very little quantity of perfume, so they are not overwhelmed, and some of them want to be overwhelmed. So everybody has the choice, and freedom is the most important thing in the world. So in the perfume, it is the same. Feel free to wear the perfume as you want.
And speaking of this, what is the best fragrance for the holiday season, besides the smell of turkey and gingerbread cookies?
The smell of turkey could be interesting. I would say maybe it is always your choice. I don't want to recommend a fragrance. It would be so easy to tell you a fragrance I created. So I would say that people have to wear the fragrance that illuminates their heart and their mood. It is the best fragrance ever for any holiday.
And one last question. What is your take on buying perfumes as gifts for other people? What is the rule here?
I would say it is very dangerous. So I would say one can offer a perfume only if the person wears it already and if it's renewing the perfume. I would say that if you don't really know what she wears or what he wears, I wouldn't advise you to offer a perfume. It's too bad, but I'm sorry, but I can't.
That was our associate editor, Nelly Gochiva, quizzing Cartier's in-house nose, Mathilde Laurent, there in London. Still to come on the show, we pull up a seat at the President's Design Awards in Singapore, and we knock on the door of master craftsman John Derrian in New York too. But before all that, a short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Revolutions are fertile conditions for filmmakers, so Monocle took a front row seat at the Doha Tribeca Film Festival to witness the cinema of change emerging in the Arab region.
Like anywhere, when there's social change, people want to raise their voices and want to share what they've been through or what they've experienced. And what I like, it's they do it in a very intimate way. And that's what we want to acknowledge as well, because I think it's stronger and smarter on the long run.
Spotlight on celluloid dreams in the Arab world, premiering on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Now, earlier this month, 13 of Singapore's top designers received the President's Design Award at a gala event hosted by the President himself, Tony Tan Keng Yam. While the awards show how serious Singapore is about becoming the next Finland in the world of design, some of the recipients said the country still has a way to go before it can successfully compete on the global stage. Monocle's Singapore correspondent, Justin Bergman, filed this report from the red carpet.
For a country the size of Singapore, this is probably as close as it gets to being at the Academy Awards. The banquet hall in the 19th century Astana House, the official residence of the president, is filled with the country's top designers, all dressed impeccably in dark suits and ball gowns. Photographers buzz around taking pictures as a cellist plays softly on stage. Then the evening's special guest arrives.
Please welcome President Tony Tan Keng Yam.
The President's Design Awards were launched 7 years ago to honor the country's top designers in everything from architecture to interior design to product design. There is a bigger objective, though. Singapore wants to become a global creative leader, and the government believes the awards can help develop talent by showing young people, and their more traditional parents, the value of pursuing a career in design. The awards are only open to Singaporeans and foreigners who are living and working in the city-state. This year, 4 individuals were recognized as Designer of the Year, and 9 projects received awards for Design of the Year. Among the winners for Designer of the Year was Voon Wong, director of the London-based design firm VW&BS. He was recognized, in part, for his redesign of Virgin Atlantic's upper-class cabin, which features a sleek 8-foot-long cocktail bar made of steel and stone and sculpted aluminum bar stools.
And here he is, Designer of the Year, Mr. Voon Wong.
I'm very honored, obviously, to be in such illustrious company, and very touched to be given this award because, you know, despite the fact that I've been away for so long, I'm always made to feel very welcome whenever I come home. And this award is, you know, is irrefutable proof of that welcome.
Wong said after the ceremony that because Singapore is becoming a global business city, it makes sense for it also to become a design hub, the same way London has.
I think the biggest challenge is probably changing the mindset of the man on the street. You know, because I think if I talk to the designers that I meet here, I don't think there is a sort of a difference between the people I meet elsewhere. They think the same way, they have the same kind of concerns, they have the same attitudes. And I think the man on the street needs to be perhaps made aware of the value of design, about what design can bring to their lives or businesses, you know, et cetera, and it's not just about sort of making a quick buck, and, you know, it's about something a bit longer term.
Another Designer of the Year was Yong Yao, Chief Creative Officer of the advertising firm JWT in Shanghai. During his acceptance speech, he spoke about how excited his family was about his invitation to the Astana, and how that felt like validation of his career choice.
When I told them about this award, they went, "Istana! Got president, ah! Can take picture with Dr. Tony Tan, ah!" Finally, after 45 years, I won an award that my mom understands and truly appreciate. And thank you to Design Singapore and its wonderful jury members for letting me win not only just this award, but help me won my in-laws over as well. This guaranteed my blissful future.
In a more serious moment later, Yong said he believes Singapore is making inroads in the design world, but is still far behind more creative countries such as Japan.
I think when I started in this industry, I feel that when we talk about design and creativity, it really wasn't in our blood. We try to, we pretend to be creative, but it wasn't in us. But I think now it's different. I mean, look at some of the award recipients today. A lot of them are a lot younger. You know, it's in their blood. You know, they breathe, they live and breathe design. They live and breathe creativity. You know, they innovate. So I think Singapore is definitely heading the right direction. We're only at a beginning. It's only, you know, foot in the door. We've got a long way to go before we reach the stage like Japan or even Bangkok. I think the creativity, it's in them. So I think we definitely have a long way to go.
One of the young designers Yong mentions is Roy Po, who won a Design of the Year award for an art project involving the browsing copies of books from bookstores. Poe invited artists to use these unsold books as canvases for artworks, and then compiled the pieces in a new publication called the Browsing Copy Project. Like many young Singaporeans, Poe's parents initially wanted him to become an engineer.
When I finished my secondary school, I couldn't get into design school at first, so I got into engineering. On the third day of school, I quit, but I didn't tell my parents until about half a year later. And when I told them that, you know, I've actually quit engineering and I'm taking up part-time graphic design course, there's nothing much you can do because, you know, I'm already halfway into it. In the early days, you know, our fathers and our mothers used to, you know, tell their children to become doctors or engineers. Nowadays, being a designer is not as embarrassing as like, let's say, 10 years ago because, you know, Singapore is evolving in terms of culture, in terms of arts, and even in terms of technology, manufacturing, and all this is kind of like interrelated. And, you know, when you have more manufacturing, you have more technology, you need more design to you know, support all this. So I feel Singapore right now is heading the right direction in terms of getting our design, you know, up there with European country or Americans and all that. The only thing I feel that Singapore don't really have a culture. We are kind of like, you know, there's Chinese, there's English, there's Eurasian, there's Indians, there's Malay. So it's kind of like a mix. So we don't really have an identity yet.
A cohesive Singaporean design community is developing, however. Sonny Lim won an award for a new football shoe he designed for Brazilian football great Pele's sportswear company. He says young designers in Singapore are supporting one another and learning from one another, and this is helping the design scene develop faster.
Of course, it's a great opportunity for dialogue. You can just go out and meet other designers very easily, and the other designers are usually from a very high caliber. And then, of course, this dialogue really stimulates creativity and also sometimes even cross-fertilization, that you collaborate on different projects and get insights from different fields of design. And that emphasizes the importance of compact design scene in Singapore as well. I mean, this kind of creative networking, that's a lot easier here than perhaps other places in the world. I grew up in the Netherlands, which is a similar small country, of course, but you know the impact that Dutch designers have and also Dutch architects have all around the world. And I foresee that Singapore could potentially play a similar role in the future as well.
Thank you very much, Justin Bergman in Singapore, for that. And from Singapore, we head next to London, to a venue we're very familiar with, the Design Museum. Over the years, the museum has housed exhibitions across a broad range of subjects, from Jaguars to washing machines and just about everything in between. Each has examined how the objects influence and improve our lives. Its latest exhibition, Unexpected Pleasures, looks at the avant-garde of contemporary jewellery and challenges conventional ideas of jewellery as a symbol of status, emotion and taste. Our reporter Hazel Pfeiffer found everything from the sublime to the astonishing, each with a story and purpose that goes far beyond simple adornment.
Inside the Design Museum's smooth, white concrete walls, something rather unexpected has occurred. For the first time, contemporary jewellery is being exhibited in a design context. The exhibition was curated by jewellery designer and maker Dr. Susan Cohn. In her introduction to the exhibition, she reflected on the relationship between jewellery and design.
I sort of think of design and contemporary jewellery as two people at a party. They've gone to lots of parties, they've always seen each other across the room. They think they know each other. They don't really. They've never had a conversation. And I think they have a lot in common and they could actually contribute to each other. They get along, they might even have an affair. But it's just so that what I'd like to see is that this conversation is opened up. And being in this museum, in this sort of context, is a really interesting way in which to re-look at what contemporary jewellery is and to see how it fits into our everyday modern culture.
For the exhibition, Susan chose pieces from the contemporary jewellery movement, which began in the late 1970s, when new processes and experimentation with materials saw a radical shift in thinking about jewellery and its place in society.
I didn't want to do something that was chronological or a survey of the makers. I wanted to look at all the range of ideas that were in the show. And the basis in which I selected people, or selected works, I should say, was quite democratic. I sent out 2,500 open invitations for people with the curatorial brief, and anyone could essentially put a submission in. So then it was a matter of selecting groups of work that work together. You know, in the show there's what I call clusters, and this is a grouping of five or six pieces that talk about a particular idea. For instance, we were talking about materials before, there's a cluster called Physical Matters, which looks at quite different, you know, paper, stone, plastic, a range of different materials and how different jewellers have used these materials.
And there's a lot of materials that are quite unusual, like bicycle chains and chewing gum. Yeah. Why did you think these were important to include?
The bicycle chain, it's a chain mechanism that works extremely well, that is not dissimilar to a lot of chain mechanisms that are used in traditional jewellery. So I think to use an existing bike chain and to develop it up into a necklace called Speed was referring to something that's in our everyday and taking it out of that and making it precious by turning it into a necklace. The chewing gum piece is where the whole idea of who is the designer of the jewelry gets flipped, because what happens is Ted Noten, who's the designer of that piece, gives chewing gum to people, or people get chewing gum from him, and they chew it up and then convert it into a shape, into what they think they would wear. They send it back to him. He gold plates it and puts a pin on the back of it and sends it back to the wearer. So the wearer, in fact, makes their piece of jewellery. And I think I enjoy when materials are used in such an inventive way.
So how did jewellery make its way from somewhere more arts and crafts orientated, like the Victoria and Albert Museum, to the Design Museum on the shores of the Thames? A panel discussion at the museum explored jewellery's place in the design world. Director of the Design Museum, Dayan Sujik, was keen to explore what jewellery and design have in common.
There's so many things about design which jewellery has a lot to say about. The way that objects become precious to us is something which occupies designers' minds and jewellers. Sometimes it's probably inappropriate to have a different job definition for those two categories of people. Design is interested in the things that make memories, or the things that we use to measure out our lives, from watches to cars to glasses. And those are the things that jewellery does too. Jewellery also asks questions about what is a piece of jewellery or what is a piece of design. So the idea of putting jewellery here was a chance to ask people to think about design in a fresh way.
Not everyone on the panel felt the same way, however. Design commentator and writer Stephen Bailey took a more traditional standpoint.
I may have a dinosaur's view of design, but you know, we dinosaurs have to stick to our beliefs. I think design is different to craft and to fine art, although I also accept that the definitions are continuously shifting and blurring. For me, design is most of all, it's an idea and an activity rather than a set of rules, but I think for something to be designed, to be called design, it has to be construed to be for a very large audience. An exhibition of what is predominantly craft jewellery in something called the Design Museum raises lots and lots of issues, which I hinted at before, that, you know, definitions of design are certainly changing, and that's a good thing. It's a very good thing the Design Museum is doing this, because it shows an eclectic view of contemporary material culture, which again is a very, very good thing. And there are aspects of jewellery which do conform even to my perhaps slightly doctrinaire definition of design. It's full of there's a functionality about jewellery. I mean, historically, the historical tradition of jewellery is it was a way of, you know, if you're a nomadic person, of carrying your wealth, portable wealth, as an interesting functional idea. And it's also always about, you know, there's the semantics of status and prestige. And these are important aspects of design.
Jewellery maker Solange Asghuri Partridge uses materials like precious metals and stones in her work, but thinks that jewellery need not be limited to such traditions.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone knows what jewellery is. I mean, as a kid, if you haven't got jewellery, you make jewellery, you create it. I mean, I used to wear elastic bands or, you know, shells from the beach or anything. Any kind of material was worthy of adornment. So I think it's good to see an exhibition like this. And also, even if you can only wear the piece for 2 minutes, it's still jewellery. It needs to be wearable. That's the one rule of jewellery, I think.
Despite questions about whether jewellery and design really speak the same language, the exhibition is designed to challenge how we think about the art of adornment and how meaning can transcend the physicality of a piece, whether it's precious or plastic.
The thing I would hope to happen out of this exhibition is that people would leave the exhibition being more aware of how they wear objects, whether it's their sunglasses or a piece of jewellery, and how that speaks for them, and how the language of design is about the language of the everyday.
For Monocle in London, I'm Hazel Pfeiffer.
Thank you, Hazel. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Still to come, we'll be attending a new exhibition in Vienna that aims to challenge the negative association many people hold when it comes to Soviet modernist architecture. That's after this short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
On assignment around the world, Monocle editors take notes on exceptional finds, from hotels to airports, luggage brands to snacks. And in our travel top 50, we share them with you.
No long-distance train ride would be complete without the perfect meal. A Japanese bento box stuffed with a sampling of the season's best is our favourite lunch on the go. And possibly just our favourite lunch. Tokyo Station's Ebinya Matsuri sells more than 150 types of bento box meals that are shipped in daily from all over the Japanese archipelago.
Discover the best in service, smiles and seamless connections by watching our Travel Top 50 slideshow on monocle.com.
Welcome back, everyone. When people who lived in the countries that once made up the communist superpower think of Soviet architecture, they see only the drab, rectangular buildings they lived and worked in, buildings of hulking, monumental, symbolic oppression. This modernist architecture dominated the Soviet cityscape for nearly 30 years, but the last decade has seen a careful re-examination of the creative skill and engineering prowess involved in building them. Our reporter, Alexei Koryolov, reports from Vienna on a new exhibition designed to give a fresh perspective to Soviet modernism.
The death of Joseph Stalin gave new life to art in the Soviet Union. Architecture was no exception. A 1954 decree by Nikita Khrushchev launched a war against superfluities in building design, and it is the starting point for an acclaimed exhibition at Vienna's downtown Architekturzentrum. Soviet Modernism, Unknown Stories, runs through the years of Leonid Brezhnev and on to Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika. Katerina Ritter is one of the curators.
We try to show with this exhibition that the wide range of architectural styles and developments within this very big union, and try to draw a different picture of this architecture, which in the Western world was not regarded to be existing at all.
The artworks, photos and films, but also authentic documents, come from the 14 non-Russian republics of the Soviet Union. These regions span a huge area, stretching from the now EU member Baltic states to the impoverished republics of Central Asia. Ritter, sitting in her office overlooking Vienna's Museumsquartier, one of the world's largest art centers, says Soviet modernist architecture, with its emphasis on novel materials and structures, is too little known and appreciated because of what she describes as its seeming inhumanity.
The Western view, but as we learned also the inside Russian view, was that it's a grey and uniform concrete architecture without human sides to it.
Indeed, for those who were living witnesses to the time, this architecture was not particularly appealing.
When I studied at Moscow's Architecture Institute, we hated this architecture.
Irina Korobinar, the director of Moscow's Shusev State Museum of Architecture, spoke at the opening of the exhibition.
We thought it epitomized ugliness, a discredit to everything. We suffered from the thought of children who were forced to live in such miserable surroundings. We thought they were depraved.
Korobinar is talking about Khrushchevki, the ubiquitous panel five-story apartment blocks that were thrown up across the Soviet Union as the country struggled to ease a massive housing crisis in the 1960s. And yet there is a certain nostalgia for Khrushchevki, which were as much a part of growing up in the 1960s as the decade's officially sanctioned pop music. Besides, says Korobinar's deputy Irina Chepkinova, they provided the much-needed housing for millions of struggling Soviet families.
True, from the point of view of an ordinary person, the architecture of the so-called Soviet modernism is bound up with the notion of poverty and the aesthetics of panel apartment blocks, the Khrushchevki. But it played an enormous role in the history of our country and beyond. It solved the problems of many people.
However, it is not just standardized dwellings for the proletariat that modernism produced. This exhibit hopes to show its more adventurous side, which was evident in the Caucasus on Russia's southern fringe. The Ministry of Highways building in the Georgian capital of Tbilisi was built in 1974. It still stands today and is as strikingly modern as ever, with its layered shape and spacecraft-style design. Its most striking feature is its location, though. It grows out of a steep hillside and literally hangs above the city. The whole exhibition, Ritter says, was inspired by the buildings in the mountainous region.
The project started more or less in the Caucasus, and from there the project got bigger and bigger, and the idea of showing the development of each country or region in comparison to the center, to Moscow, it became obvious that you have to show all four regions in order to show the development as a whole.
But despite its political and cultural prominence, Moscow is restricted to a minor role in the show. And this is only partly because it would have overshadowed the smaller regions, says Ekaterina Shapiro-Obermai, who researched the exhibition.
In Russia, there are only few people who really accept that that was a certain development there.
She says that's because of snobbery among Russian scholars about the architectural stature of the Kremlin's former subordinates. But Irina Chepkinova of Moscow's Shusev State Museum of Architecture says the Architekturzentrum was wrong to exclude her homeland from the exposition.
To view the architecture of this period without Russia is wrong, because the architects all received their education at Moscow's Architecture Institute and the connections were there anyway.
However, her boss, Irina Korobina, admits that it would be impossible to hold such a show in Moscow.
Nobody would attend such an exhibition in Moscow. It would be torn to pieces. For us, this history is not distant enough. It is still part of our time.
Oddly enough, it also feels like that for France, a visitor at the show who says that the new facade of Vienna's Westbahnhof railway station reminds him and his girlfriend of some of the exhibits.
The architecture seems to be really modern, like if you see it now. Just today, like we saw the new building at the Westbahnhof, and I think we really took a lot of things from these socialist architects that are like part of the standard architecture now.
It is people like Franz who will decide the future of this architecture. Will it be forgotten and left to rot away like so many of the Khrushchevki apartment blocks? Or will it be celebrated, and perhaps even inspire new architectural flights of fancy? That, ultimately, is the hope of the curators of this groundbreaking show. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Soviet Modernism Unknown Stories runs until February, so if you're in the Austrian capital, do go and check it out. For our final package on this episode of Section D, we're off to New York. The art of decoupage, the ancient tradition of decorating objects with intricate paper cutouts, is not something we've given much air to on this year in Section D. But New York-based John Derrian, whose studio turns out thousands of handmade decoupage glass pieces each year, recently came to our attention, and we were intrigued. Derrian began experimenting with decoupage in the 1980s, focusing largely, as he does today, on colourful images mostly from the 1800s. From a loft studio space just off the Bowery in Manhattan, Derrian directs a staff of 20 artisans who spend their day crafting elaborate glass plates and trays, combining a curious range of printed images from days gone by. Monocle's Barrett Austin dropped by and sat down with Derrian for a chat about his extraordinary work.
The orders come into the studio and they first come to Greg, my studio manager, and then he basically processes them and organizes what materials need to get printed and cut. And then the materials come to the cutter and he cuts the images that need to go. And then from the cutter they go to the gluers, and there's different people that glue different things. Like some people glue like the three-dimensional things, which are a bit more labor-intensive and layered. A lot of the other things are just one image. And then once the gluers finish their gluing, then they get finished. And the finish is basically check the edges, make sure the work is glued well, and then they paint the backs or finish the backs, whether it's painting or felting, or like we do a varnish too for some of the things that are a little bit more user-friendly.
How did this idea, the idea of doing decoupage, come about? Because it's not exactly an art form that most young people say, oh, I want to be a painter, or I want to be a sculptor, and they sort of go after it.
I was very crafty as a kid. I made lots of things, and mostly one-of-a-kind items like painted furniture and boxes covered in maps, and I had sort of amassed all these paper goods, and it was sort of like an accident. This woman that painted furniture in a shop that I sold to gave me some plates and said, oh, you should try making something with these plates. I'll work on the back of these plates and make like a collage or something. I was like, okay. So I went to my studio and I made a couple and I sold them, and then I guess that's how it started. It was just sort of an accident.
And if we could talk just a bit about the craft, what exactly is decoupage? What is it that you're producing here in the shop?
It's the art of cutting and gluing, or cutting and pasting things to surfaces. We work on the reverse of things, so it's a little different for us than normal decoupage, which is supposed to be on, like, on an exterior of something. Parichomania is also another term that's used to describe what I do, because it's making things look like porcelain, because in the end you can't really tell what anything is, and it does look like it's porcelainware. So basically, it's reprinting imagery. I mean, or you can use original imagery, but you will destroy it with the glue. So it's reprinting imagery and piecing it back together under glass, sort of like, basically like a collage under glass.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the images that you pull from. How would you describe the images that you use?
So the image is all 19th century or earlier. 17th century stuff is really amazing. It's much sharper and a bit naive. Basically, I gravitate towards things that are it's all sort of natural history, fruit, flowers, animals, and a lot of ephemera. I like sort of funny, kooky things too, hand-drawn things. Sometimes I find images like that are fun to play with.
When did you start doing this, and what were some of the first images that you pulled from?
The first couple of plates I did were actually kind of Victorian, like little Victorian cutouts that I glued, that I sort of ruined with the glue and stuff, because it's what I had access to at the time. And then I was in New York City doing some work for a magazine. I got hold of their sort of Canon laser printer, and they started printing things. And then I was able to glue those things much easier. And they took the glue well. It was smooth. It's like a light safe ink and acid free paper. They last forever. So it suddenly was like opened up my eyes to like, wow, look, I can actually repeat these things. Because until that point, I'd only made one of a kind things that I couldn't actually reproduce. So it was sort of suddenly cool that I had like these things that I was making that I could like make multiples of.
And the images that you pull from today, how do you find these? How do you go about finding the old images?
Everything that I use in my work is from a book. So people didn't have, you know, TV or movies and stuff back then. So all these images were sort of drawn just for people to know, like, different kinds of bugs or houses or drainage. Or I mean, it's crazy the kind of things you can find in books. Most of the images come from dealers, like book dealers, print dealers, trade shows, antique shops, print shops, flea markets, that kind of thing.
What are some of your favorite places to go? Like, what are the ultimate sources for finding great images?
I have two great sources in New York. Actually, one just moved to London, so I have one great source in New York. There's a really good shop on Lexington called the Old Print Shop, and they're really great. They have beautiful things. And then the New York flea market at the garage, there's a guy there who I get a lot of stuff from. And the other guy who I've been buying a lot from just moved to London, but now we've been corresponding, so now he's shipping me stuff.
And which of the images are more popular amongst customers? What's popular, what's not popular?
People are not popular. people images are a little tricky. I don't know why. But most other things, I think all the images sort of, the images that I use, I feel like evoke sort of things in people, like emotions, or you have a connection to a certain image, like, oh, I had a summer house and I had that, we had rabbits, and so they buy a rabbit plate. Or I had somebody bought a rat image because I have a rat plate in the store, and somebody had some weird rat thing happen recently, so they got the rat as a joke gift for a friend.
And what are some of your own favorite images?
There's this one that's like an empty room that's pink. It's like a pink room, which I love. There's one that's a drawing from the turn of the century by this little kid that was like circles of color called Intervals of Sevenths, and he spelled intervals wrong. So we have some stores that won't buy it because it's spelled wrong, but we're like, it's a 19th century image. There's humor in that. So we actually did have some funny animal images that people asked if we would take the genitalia away, which we didn't, and so they didn't order them.
That was our New York researcher, Barrett Austin, with local craftsman John Derrian in his beautiful studio there. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Section D. It's the last regular Section D of 2012, but fear not, we'll be back with a very festive Christmas special edition at the same time next Tuesday. And at 7 a.m. London time on Thursday the 27th of December, tune in for my special design roundtable hour on The Globalist, where we speak to Dayan Sujic, director of the Design Museum, Alana Weston, creative director of Selfridges, and we host a round table with four leading names from the world of graphic design too. But all that's left is for me to thank our producer Gillian DeBias and editor Holly Fisher for all their hard work this year. I'm going to leave you with my absolute favourite song of the year. Here's Solange Knowles with Losing You. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.